Please be seated. Are there any students? I say this in jest. Are there any students here today?
Well, we don't have students, but we do have some members of the Wabak County Leadership Group, Wapaka County Leadership Group. So I recognize some friendly faces. We chatted a little bit earlier this week, and I'm glad you took us up on the offer to come and visit with us today. So as we begin, I will call our last case of the day, State versus McAllister, 14AP 2561. Counsel, are you ready to begin?
Yes, sir.
Please do.
May it please the court. My name is Robert Hennick, and I have the honor of representing David McAllister on this appeal. As a matter of fact, the last 30 years I've had the privilege of representing any number of criminal defendants who have been convicted of crimes and have subsequently sought to hold the criminal justice system to its promise of making sure that trials, convictions are fairly achieved. Sometimes that can be done on the direct appeal. Sometimes I have found that can take as much as 10, 20 years after the conviction before the truth actually comes out. And in those cases, my clients, those who have been exonerated, have benefited from the fact that the legislature of this state and the courts of this state have provided a means for raising the newly discovered evidence claims under 97406. I say with certainty that the legislature has provided that because if you look at section 805.16 sub 5, which is cited in my reply brief, the legislature specifically states that the time limits applicable in civil cases for raising newly discovered evidence claims do not apply to newly discovered evidence claims raised under 97406. Now, if the legislature believed that 97406 that you could not raise a newly discovered evidence claim under 97406, it certainly would not have said in explicit words that you can raise such a claim at any time. So moving on to the specific standards for such a claim, it's important, I think, for the public, for litigants, and for the circuit court judges to have consistent and logical rules when we're applying these standards. Now, just to refresh the court's recollection, when bringing a newly discovered evidence claim, the defendant is required to prove by clear and convincing evidence, number one, that the evidence is new, number two, that the defendant was not negligent in failing to find it, number three, that it's not cumulative, number four, that it's material. If all those are shown, and there's no dispute that those are all shown in Mr. McAllister's case, then we move on to the issue of whether there is a reasonable probability of a different result. This court has held that there's no burden of proof on that because it contains its own burden of proof. Reasonable probability of a different result. And most of the issues, I think all of the remaining issues in this case, address what that means and how you prove it and what the court's obligations are in addressing that. First, the issue of the standard of review of that. Logic, consistency. Every other place that I can find in which the courts address appellate standards of review for a reasonable probability of a different result, acknowledge that that is a issue of law that is reviewed de novo. Whether it is the materiality standard for a Brady issue, whether it is resulting prejudice in an ineffectiveness claim, even harmless error, although it's not exactly the same language, It is all a issue reviewed de novo. The state in this case is asking the court to carve out an exception for newly discovered evidence cases in which it is asking the court to review those as a matter of erroneous exercise of discretion.
Counsel, could I ask you and perhaps to step back a half a step and go back to these new evidence factors, and you recited them as I understand them to be, but it appears to me, or my sense of it is, that hiding behind those four factors is this question of, well, is this evidence have some measure of reliability, right? Isn't that part of the analysis that the court has to do?
Yes. It basically comes down to, can a reasonable jury believe it sufficiently enough to have a reasonable doubt as to guilt?
Okay. Yes. Now, when the newly discovered evidence, and I know there's some disagreement between the two of you about whether this is recantation evidence, but when if it is recantation, then there needs to be corroboration.
Correct.
Of some sort, correct?
Correct.
And that's a consideration separate and apart from what a jury would likely do with that evidence.
Correct. The corroboration under the Dunleavy case merely has to be of some material aspect of the recantation. It does not have to be, for instance, somebody else who was there at the same time and saw everything. It doesn't have to be physical evidence. It doesn't have to be another eyewitness to the case. It just has to...
So what we're looking for in that, though, is some indication of reliability that this recantation is actually legitimate.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And one thing I would ask the court to keep in mind is, because it sometimes gets mushed together in cases like this, there is reliability and then there is credibility, and those are two related but separate things. For instance, the courts... historically, in looking at whether they are going to substitute a judicial determination for a jury determination, either in the past or in the future, always have said the jury is entitled to make that decision unless the evidence is incredible as a matter of law. Now, that is contrary to the laws of nature or fully established or conceded facts.
Counsel, what weight, if all, should we give the fact that Mr. McAllister waited about 7 years before this evidence came forward?
Probably the same weight that we give to alleged victims of crime who wait in the McGuire case, I think it was 35 years, which is that does not go to the issue of whether or not it is incredible as a matter of law. It certainly is something that a jury could take into account. But what we are talking about now is whether or not the allegations of the motion were adequate to require a hearing, and then two, after that hearing, whether it's adequate to require a new trial.
What about the fact that Mr. McAllister's niece was one of the perpetrators in both of these robberies for which he was convicted as party to the crime? Should we wonder why she's not involved in any of his purported proofs here?
We can wonder about a lot of things.
Should it matter?
And it causes suspicion.
Yeah.
It causes suspicion, yes.
Right.
And as this court has said several times, suspicion is why we leave that to the jury. I don't know from the record exactly why she wasn't called. She was, of course, alleged to have been a party to each of these robberies. So, of course, there could be a Fifth Amendment issue. I don't know. It's not in the record that I know of.
Okay. Thank you.
And I must apologize. Since I came on so late in the case, I did not have as full a knowledge of the record, and also getting a box of documents from a pro se defendant, I did not have as full an understanding of the record as I would if I had had the case from the beginning. I apologize for that.
Thank you. No apologies necessary. You were good to pick it up.
Continuing on with the difference between reliability and incredibility. Incredibility is incredible as a matter of law. If it's incredible as a matter of law, then we do not allow a jury to even consider it. They are, it's not something that you can say, well, the jury can figure that out. Reliability, however, we have the general understanding that a recantation, whatever, however that is defined, is unreliable. We also have the understanding that an alleged co-defender testifying in order to mitigate the consequences of their own misconduct are inherently reliable, are unreliable, sorry, inherently unreliable. So the meaning of reliability is not the same as incredible. Reliability is an issue for the jury. Credibility, if they are totally incredible, is not.
What should we? What concern should we have is what we have our hearsay affidavits?
What we have are sworn affidavits by individuals who heard prior inconsistent statements.
They're hearsay.
Actually, under 801, 04 sub 1, whatever. It is defined by the statute as non-hearsay. A prior statement of a witness that is inconsistent with their sworn testimony is a prior inconsistent statement.
Okay. So we shouldn't be concerned at all about the fact that the people who supposedly perjured themselves at the time of Mr. McAllister's trial are not involved in this personally with their own affidavit saying.
It is an issue for the jury, yes. When we look at the Brown case from 1980, the court there specifically stated that when you are looking at an in-court witness, which would be these three persons who have sworn to the affidavits, they will be in court, their demeanor will be able to be assessed in court, they will be testifying under oath. Those are the standard traditional means of guaranteeing reliability of a statement. And the court in Brown specifically said, this court in Brown specifically said that it was error for the lower courts to take into account issues of credibility regarding those witnesses. That is for the jury as long as, again, it's not incredible as a matter of law.
Counsel, is there, I'm trying to figure out, there's got to be some way of screening statements like this, right? I mean, you know, if you can get a hearing just because somebody who's got a life sentence with no possibility of extended release, extended supervision, says, oh, I heard X, it can't be that easy, can it?
Sorry, Your Honor, but it's that easy to convict somebody. We can have somebody come in and testify for the state who has a life sentence and really has nothing to gain or to lose, and we don't say, well, that person's testimony is inherently incredible.
Yeah, so we're a little bit of a different procedural posture here, though, right? We're after conviction.
Yep.
There is an interest in finality to these kinds of cases.
Yes.
And, you know, so I understand the importance of having an opportunity to challenge a conviction. However, this is a different procedural posture. And if you get a new trial, every time someone pops up and says, I heard X, that can't be the rule, can it?
And it is not. And that's not the rule that we're asking for.
So what's the screening function that the court can do on this? So they can look at these affidavits and they say, is this something that I need to institute a new trial? What's that screening process look like?
Screening process, number one, has to take into account the settled rule that the allegations of the motion must be accepted as true for purposes of deciding whether to have a hearing. That's one of the major issues that the circuit court, the lower courts, overlooked in this case. Unless from the face of the affidavits, they're incredible as a matter of law. Once you get to the hearing, then you have the witnesses come in. There have been cases, I know that my law partner has seen, where the witness comes in and says, oh, no, I didn't sign that. That's not my affidavit. And it's not true. Then we obviously don't have a new trial because the affidavit is not supported by the testimony at the hearing. It might come in at the hearing that the, like in this case, where the witnesses in their affidavits say that I met with the state's witnesses at a particular place when we were in jail together. If it turns out that they were not in jail together, or the other person was not in that place at that time, then we have, as a matter of laws of nature, the allegation that he was there and heard these things. That's simply not true. However, if the witness testifies and that testimony is not incredible as a matter of law, then under historic traditional standards, whether it's for proving guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, or in this case, proving something much less, doesn't even have to be more likely than not, if that evidence is not incredible as a matter of law, then we leave it to the jury to decide. That's the way that we do things when we address, you know, reasonable doubt. It doesn't matter if I come in after a conviction and say, well, Judge, you know, the state's witness was, you know, he was sentenced to life without parole. He's not credible. Or I come in and say, that witness made 16 different contrary statements. He's not credible. Or come in and say he has a bias because he got a deal, a great deal from the state. He's not credible. And if I made any of those arguments, this court would rightly shoot me down and say, we leave those issues to the jury. We do not interfere as a court in what a jury has to decide. And the same standard, logic and consistency, same standard should apply when we're looking at what a future jury would do.
Do we have an affidavit from Mr. McAllister saying he's innocent?
No, we do not. What we have is...
Isn't it usual in these cases that that's a requirement, that he's got to assert his innocence, that we're not just chasing the legal issue here?
No.
No.
No. That, no. I have
but
very
there is
rarely
no affidavit
that.
Here.
I'm sorry?
There is no affidavit here.
There is no affidavit here. What there is the allegations of the motion. And keep in mind that the there is no requirement of affidavits in these cases. There's only a requirement of allegations in the motion of non-conclusory material statements of fact. It's a different Brown case. I'm sorry, I don't have the citation off the top of my head, but I believe it's in my briefs. That the defendant must make sufficient non-conclusory allegations of fact to entitle them to relief. They have to do that in order to get a hearing. Then they have to prove up those statements at the hearing. And once you prove them up at the hearing, if you have, then you're entitled to a new trial. It is not a requirement of newly discovered evidence that the defendant affirmatively say that he is not guilty. Sometimes in, for instance, a motion to withdraw a plea prior to trial, fair and just reason type case, it is an important factor for the defendant to say, and by the way, I am not guilty. But I have never seen a requirement of that in a motion like this based on newly discovered evidence or ineffective assistance of counsel or anything like that. You know, traditionally, by pleading not guilty, the defendant has made that assertion. And
so mine was an affidavit of innocence, which in my view is different than an affirmation that you're, quote, not guilty, as a jury would find you. I think they're two different things.
Oh, certainly. Okay. I totally agree.
Okay. I'm just waving at our students, their leadership from Wapaka County, who are very interested in what you're doing. Please.
Yeah, I'm sorry if I chased
somebody off. No, it's okay.
No.
Nothing personal.
Not at all.
Okay.
They were enjoying the argument. They asked, could they please come for part of it if they couldn't stay for all of it? And I said, yes.
Oh, certainly. Certainly. Glad they were here. So we have standard of review. We have consistency in terms of how courts address assessment of credibility that's going to be made by the jury. And for that, again, if it is not incredible as a matter of law, we traditionally have left that to the jury. Three, a motion like this, in order to get a hearing, we have to accept under standard conditions, we have to accept the properly pled allegations as true. That's something that the lower courts did not do in this case. Going in and making a personal subjective assessment of the credibility of these witnesses before having a hearing simply is not what judges are directed to do under Balliet and Allen and those cases.
Counsel, the state advances on the standard of review question that the standard of review with regard to the reasonable probability requirement should be a deferential standard.
Yes, it does.
Why not? Or why? You contest that, so tell me why you're contesting it.
Okay. I guess technically, given how this court has defined the general standard of review for newly discovered evidence, it would be deferential in the sense that it's erroneous exercise of discretion as a whole, when you're looking at the newly discovered evidence decision as a whole. However, keep in mind that even that deferential standard requires that the court apply the standards of law appropriately. And in deciding that part, whether they applied the standards of law appropriately, even in a erroneous exercise of discretion case, that issue is legal, and that issue is reviewed de novo. And, for instance, this court in Plude specifically said that issue, that reasonable probability of a different result, even though it's within the context of a broader erroneous exercise of discretion review, still has to be reviewed de novo. Just quickly addressing the recantation issue. There is no recantation here. We are not talking about recantations. We are talking about prior inconsistent statements. And again, looking for logic and consistency, nowhere can I find in the law of the state that a prior inconsistent statement is deemed unreliable. Nowhere in the law of the state that I have found that a prior inconsistent statement requires corroboration.
Well, it's not the prior inconsistent statement is the statements of the people who testified against McAllister, and they were at the time of conviction deemed to be a co-perpetrator. But what we are looking at is the statement of a third party. Their statement, the third party's statement, is not a prior inconsistent statement. It's just their statement made under oath of what they heard.
That's correct. And under Brown, those statements it is error for the lower courts to assess the credibility of those statements. What needs to be addressed in this case is the recantation or the prior inconsistent statement of the people who testified. That's what needs to be analyzed. The statement of Antonio Shannon.
How can you analyze it through hearsay, even if you had a trial on this issue? How can you analyze something through hearsay? You're not going to get this guy to be able to testify under oath. I heard Sam say X.
Under, let's see, I can't remember, 808.06, perhaps, the rules of evidence say that you can address the credibility of a hearsay declarant or a hearsay statement under exactly the same standards as you can address the credibility of any other witness. In this case, the statement that is the prior inconsistent statement that is reflected in the affidavits of the three witnesses is a prior inconsistent statement. It is not hearsay. It is deemed admissible for its truth under this court's decision in Vogel. It is deemed reliable. The way that you address that is if there is anything in the statement, prior inconsistent statement, that is contrary to the laws of nature, then you can say, well, that is unreliable, that is incredible. But if there is nothing in the statement itself, the prior inconsistent statement here, you can't say that it is incredible because you don't want to believe or you have some reason to question the witness who heard and is bringing into court the fact that that statement was made by the prior state's witness.
So with respect to the corroboration requirement and whether this is a recantation, let me just cut to the heart of the concern. As you might imagine, the concern here is that these affidavits are not actually true. And so let's say that one of the affiants said that he heard the relevant parts after the trial. Why would we analyze that differently just because he decided to make up his story so that the statements came after the trial rather than before?
First of all, under Brown and even under McCallum, you're not analyzing the witnesses who are testifying about having heard the recantation or the prior inconsistent statement. Under Brown, you know, again, unless that is contrary or incredible as a matter of law, that's for the jury to decide. But we go into this. Somebody has sworn under oath that these things happened. I guess what I'm having problems with, and I see my light is red.
Yes.
But what I'm having problems with is the idea that we assume that they are lying when they are telling something under oath.
Well, and perhaps that's because two out of the three of them are immune to perjury charges.
And all three of them, however, the idea of the oath is that there is something higher than the law of the state, that when you are swearing to testify, that there is something higher than that making you testify correctly and honestly. And also when we look at the specifics in each of these affidavits, these aren't just affidavits saying, I heard him say this. There is great detail in these affidavits, the kind of detail that most people that I know in prison are not smart enough to just make up things like that.
Counsel,
so
your red light's on.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Scott Rosenell, appearing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. Justice Kelly has some excellent questions about reliability and the circuit court screening function, so I'd like to start there.
Let me make sure that you speak up. We're having difficulty with our microphones.
Yeah, you might move the microphone up, and you might even raise the podium a little bit.
Where's the button again right here?
I think it's on the right. Yeah, you got it. Good. Got it. Yeah, that'll probably help.
Better?
Yeah. Thank you.
We want to hear every word that you say.
Thanks. So getting back to the court screening function, so I think there are a couple, I guess two different types of credibility determinations that are not really in play here, but kind of being discussed. So one type of credibility determination is what Justice Kelly would refer to as a circuit court screening function in a newly discovered evidence case. And there are different terms or different phrases that have been thrown around. Sometimes the case law refers to incredible as a matter of law or somewhat similarly inherently incredible. Justice Abrahamson's concurrence in McCallum back in 1997 uses the phrase worthy of belief. In some other cases like Kivioha and Ferguson have repeated a lot of these same expressions. And I think those expressions are all dealing with the same thing. It's basically reliability. Is the newly discovered evidence reliable enough to go to a jury? And actually one important point that Justice Abrahamson's concurrence made in McCallum was that the jury's, and I'm kind of getting over to the second aspect of credibility here. The jury's role is to decide whom to believe, and the jury's role is to decide what's true and what's false. A circuit court does not make that kind of determination when it looks at newly discovered evidence. It simply determines, and this is paraphrasing from Justice Abrahamson's concurrence, the circuit court simply determines whether the new evidence is worthy of belief for a jury, whether it's credible enough to go to the jury. So the circuit court's not deciding what's right and what's wrong or what's true and what's false. It's just, is this credible enough for us to have another trial? Which brings me to another point Justice Kelly asked about. This is a very different procedural posture than like the State versus Brown case that Attorney Hennig was referring to. In those kinds of cases, there is a trial, and the circuit court cannot exclude certain evidence from getting admitted just because the court says, I don't think it's credible. But the posture is different here. It's not what evidence can come in at trial. The issue is whether there's going to be another trial at all, because there was one a decade ago when the district officer was found guilty. So, and I'd like to get to the standard of review a little bit. So Attorney Hennig and I, based on what he said earlier today, we seem to be on the same page that the standard of review for newly discovered evidence, including the fifth prong, the reasonable probability prong, is whether a circuit court misused its discretion. And I believe that's what Justice Abrahamson advocated for in her concurrence in McCallum as well. And within that misuse of discretion deferential standard, there is a de novo aspect, whether the circuit court applied correct or appropriate legal principles. And it did in this case because it said the affidavits are inherently unbelievable. And going back to McCallum and plenty of cases since then, circuit courts can say this new evidence is incredible, and as a result, it fails the reasonable probability requirement.
Why would we, in this kind of a case, the posture that we have here, where the circuit court denied an evidentiary hearing, not have a de novo review? The premise of my question is this. Sometimes with regard to the issue of credibility, we say, well, listen, the judges are on the front line, they hear the witnesses, they see the body motions and postures and responses, and they are better placed to assess credibility, and therefore we defer to their determination. Here, the judge is no better than, well, I don't know if I want to say it. The judge is no better than we are. That doesn't quite sound right, but let me try to rephrase that. Isn't in no better position than we are. The judge, and these kind of years later, 974-06 motions, very likely is not the trial judge. Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't, but years have passed. So the judge here is doing it on a written record. Why aren't we just as good, let me return that phrase in a different way, as the circuit court judge in determining the reasonable probability? The circuit court judge has no one-up on us because there has been no evidentiary hearing. Can you respond to that, please?
Sure, and I guess I have 2 points to make in response. The first one is I think the circuit court judge is in a better position still. And the reason why is because the circuit court judge presided over the trial. And there is actually case law, I forget the name of the case, but Justice Abrahamson's concurrence in McCallum referred to it. And the case law is that if a circuit judge presided over trial, but there's a different judge that looks at the new evidence, then it is de novo review. But in this case, it is the same judge who presided over the trial. So the idea is that she's a lot more familiar with the case and was able to at least see certain witnesses testify at the trial, and this court isn't as familiar with the case and didn't see any witnesses at trial.
Keep your second reason in mind, because I want to ask a follow-up to the this first reason. And that is, I believe we have to try to keep the law as simple as we can. It's hard enough. And so these kinds of cases, I traditionally like ineffective assistance of counsel in some ways. You know, it's in certain aspects, it's de novo review. Now you're saying, oh no, it should be a hybrid, and it should be a hybrid with a deferential component, but only a hybrid with a deferential component in cases where the judge 10 years ago heard the case. Too confusing. Keep it simple. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm not saying that's what the standard should be. I'm saying that's what the standard is. And right. I think it's justified. I don't think that the de novo aspect is really any more confusing in this case than others, because in a whole host of cases dealing with a lot of different areas of the law, there is a deferential misuse of discretion standard. But in all these other areas of the law, there always is a de novo aspect as to whether the circuit court applied the correct legal standards. So I don't think it's that confusing. I think the lower courts are able to figure out the standard of review and see which issues get which standard and things like that. If I may, I could turn to the second sort of point I had in response to your initial question, Justice Bradley.
Please.
So it's maybe more of a question than a point, really. Why even hold a hearing? So if McAllister's position is circuit courts can't make credibility assessments because that would usurp the jury's function, or at least they can't do that unless the evidence is incredible as a matter of law, then why even have a hearing? If evidence is incredible as a matter of law, that means it's inherently incredible, incredible on its face. So why do you have to see a witness's demeanor while testifying to decide whether it's inherently incredible? And I think the evidence in this case is inherently incredible or unworthy of belief or whatever expression you want to use, really. And there are a few points I'd like to really emphasize. A couple are in my brief. A couple aren't in my brief or aren't as clear as they could be. One of them relates to the niece, which Chief Justice referred to earlier. So one of the affidavits says that, I think it was Jefferson, one of the accomplices, Jefferson and Waters, one of them allegedly told one of these three affiants that those two men, Waters and Jefferson, were the only two people who robbed the Title Loan store. But we know from impartial, unbiased witnesses, eyewitnesses who were the victims of that robbery, that there were actually three robbers, two men and a woman. And we know from Waters and Jefferson's trial testimony that the woman was McAllister's niece. So why would this affidavit say there were only two men at the robbery when we know there were two men and a woman? It's because they're not only trying to absolve or exonerate McAllister, they're trying to make McAllister's niece look like she wasn't involved either. And why would they do that? Because she's not just some random woman who was at the robbery participating. It was McAllister's niece, which, if she was involved, that would strongly suggest that maybe McAllister was involved as well. So that's one of the incredible things about these affidavits. Another point that I'd like to talk about is how Shannon is one of the three affiants. So he claims to have seen Jefferson, one of the robbers, one of McAllister's accomplices. He claimed to have seen a robber fleeing from the Title Loan store. His head was covered by his hood, and he claimed that he was there with his friend Amanda, and there's actually a police report in my supplemental appendix where somebody named Amanda, presumably the same person, said, I couldn't tell what race the guy was. I assume he was a guy. I couldn't even tell that much because the person's head was completely covered by a hood. So despite the guy's head being covered, this affiant, Shannon, claims that he was in jail with Jefferson 2 years later and then all of a sudden recognized him as the robber he saw 2 years earlier, and then lo and behold, he confesses to framing McAllister for that robbery, or says that he will frame him for that robbery. One other point I'd like to make is, although the timelines are a little confusing or maybe unclear in these affidavits, one thing that's clear is two of the inmates were in jail, in Racine County Jail, and I hope I don't get these names wrong, but I believe it was with Jefferson. And one of the affidavits, I think it's McPherson's, he refers to Waters and says, I was in prison with Waters in Dodge Correctional. But before that, Waters told me he was in, guess where, Racine County Jail. And while he was there, he sent a letter to the other accomplice, Jefferson, to coordinate their lies. And then he rehearsed those lies with this affiant, McPherson. Well, that raises a whole bunch of obvious questions. Number one, if Waters and Jefferson were both in Racine County Jail, were they there together? If they were, why didn't they rehearse their lies together? Why would he have to rehearse them in a different institution with some other person? So there are a whole bunch of really obvious unanswered questions. A couple other ones are, how did two of the three affiants even meet McAllister or get in contact with him and provide the affidavits to him? We don't know because they never bothered to explain. The only one who does explain is Corey Prince, and his explanation is completely unbelievable, to put it mildly. He says, I just happened to overhear one of the accomplices say he was going to frame McAllister. Oh, he didn't even name him. He just said, I'm going to frame the older man in some case I'm involved in. And then 6 years later, small world, He just happens to be in prison with McAllister and hears McAllister complain about being framed by those same guys. So it's all these little things. I don't think any single one of them, even like the fact that two guys are serving life sentences, I don't think the court could look at any one of them and say, oh, that's unbelievable. But when you put them all together, as I have in that fairly lengthy analysis, my brief, I think when you put it all together, then it shows that these things are inherently incredible, unworthy of belief, however you want to put it. And the circuit, even under de novo review, I think that's the case, but under the case law, I've cited some of my brief, I believe it was page 21, the standard of review is whether the court misused its discretion in finding this stuff incredible as a matter of law. And it certainly did not misuse its discretion. If I may, I'd like to turn to the recantation issue a little bit. So I'm going to coin a term here. I'm going to call it, just maybe for convenience today, a precantation. So that's recantation with the letter P at the beginning. Okay. So that's really what we're dealing with here. So the allegation is not that witnesses testified and then after testifying saying our testimony was false, as I'm sure the court is aware, is a little different timing-wise. Even though this new evidence is coming to light after trial, it's still the allegation is still that these people apparently, allegedly admitted before trial that they were going to commit perjury in the future. So that's why I'm calling it a precantation. And there are really two sub-issues to that, the precantation issue. The first one is, do these precantations have to be corroborated just like to the typical recantations do? And the second sub-issue would be, are these precantations adequately corroborated? And turning to the first point, or the first sub-issue, I think they do have to be corroborated. And Justice Kelly asked a really excellent question, which you read my mind, actually, Your Honor. My question was going to be, what if these affiants, instead of saying a few months before trial, instead said a few months after trial, these two accomplices said that they had committed perjury a few months earlier? I think we'd be in the same position we're in now. And if the court were to hold that the very small timing issue, even though there's really no distinction between the two, if that timing issue is enough to avoid the corroboration requirement, then we're going to have defendants raising precantations instead of recantations in their newly discovered evidence motions, which are pretty common across the state. So I think the court really has to hold that precantations do need to be corroborated because, after all, they are still inherently unreliable. They are still admissions to perjury. I think an admission to future perjury is just as unreliable as an admission to past perjury. As for the second sub-issue, I don't think these affidavits were, or these allegations, rather, were adequately corroborated. And I've cited a couple of cases. There's a Seventh Circuit case, and there's also Ferguson from the Wisconsin Court of Appeals a few years ago. And those cases basically say when you have unreliable affidavits, they can't corroborate each other. And the reason why is because every single one of them is uncorroborated. So the math basically is BS plus BS equals BS. So I don't really see how you can...
So I don't get that.
Well, maybe really? 0 plus 0 equals 0.
Oh, that I understand.
That math is well established in the case law. I know that much. Okay. So I don't think that you can just point to one affidavit and corroborate with another one. There are a couple of hypotheticals you can maybe consider. I think that would be worthwhile. One is a guy is convicted of, say, murder, and then 10 years later, he gets two affidavits, and he moves for a new trial, and the affidavits are from mom and dad. And they say our son couldn't have committed the murder because we were having dinner with him on the night in question 10 years ago. Well, would a circuit court really have to hold a hearing? Like, sure, that wouldn't, as Attorney Hennig would put it, that wouldn't conflict with the laws of nature, but that's not really the test. And I've quoted it in my brief. The test is not would it conflict with the laws of nature or laws of physics. It's would it be intrinsically improbable or have physical improbabilities or be inherently unbelievable? And I think affidavits from mom and dad in that situation would be, because why didn't they come forward when their son was on trial 10 years ago? And if people can't remember what they had for dinner 3 nights ago, how could they remember what they had for dinner and who they were with 10 years ago? Another good example that's actually from a case that I cited in my brief, it's Murray versus Dello from 1994, an Eighth Circuit case. In that case, a defendant was convicted of homicide, sentenced to prison. I think he's actually sentenced to death. And his brother filed an affidavit about maybe, I think it was 10 years later, 11 years later, something like that. And his brother took credit for the homicide for which the defendant had been sentenced to death. But here's the catch. The brother was serving a life sentence without parole. So that's probably why he was willing to take credit. And one point the court made was, why didn't he come forward when the brother was facing a capital trial a decade earlier? Well, because in the intervening time, he was convicted and sentenced to life himself. So that's why he was willing to try to get to save his brother's life by filing a bogus affidavit. And these kinds of things are far too common in the circuit courts in Wisconsin, especially in Milwaukee County. These kinds of motions are a dime a dozen. And circuit courts they absolutely need to have discretion to deny them without a hearing. And when I say without a hearing, I'd like to note that the circuit court in this case did hold a hearing. It didn't just summarily deny the claim without really giving it 2 seconds thought. The court had briefs from both parties, held a non-evidentiary hearing. McAllister appeared pro se, and ADA appeared. They argued it. The court considered all the arguments and then decided the allegations were inherently not believable. Circuit courts need to have discretion to do that. They don't need to hold evidentiary hearings and waste everyone's time, because if the court held a hearing in this case, it could say the exact same thing it said after the non-evidentiary hearing. Based on all the same considerations I put in my brief, this stuff is inherently incredible, and I think we'd be in the exact same position we're in now. So I don't really see need for hearing. And I don't have anything more to say unless this court has any questions for me. Okay.
Thank you.
I ask that the Court of Appeals decision be affirmed. Thank you.
May I, Your Honor? First of all, Justice Kelly, I think what you're probably getting at is floodgates. Concerns that, you know, if we actually apply the rules, consistently with how we've looked at things elsewhere, that we're going to have all kinds of motions and all kinds of people getting new trials or at least hearings. And I think the answer to that, the primary answer to that, is this is not an easy standard to meet, even separate from the requirement of a reasonable probability of a different result. You have to show that it's new. You have to show that you were not negligent in failing to find it. The vast majority of the hypotheticals that the state came up with here could be resolved by just pointing out that the lawyer should have known that. The defendant would have known that he was having dinner with his parents. That's not something that's going to be newly discovered evidence, and nobody's going to take it seriously, not because they aren't telling the truth, but because that's something that you would have known and would have been able to find out reasonably.
Well, if I might just push back on that a little bit, and perhaps you can tell me where I'm wrong on this. I am concerned about the floodgates, and part of the reason for that is this is not a hard thing to do, to find somebody in jail willing to make up a story. And just by evidence of that, anecdotal, of course, I've been on the bench now for a year and a half, and I've already seen a significant number of affidavits just like this. So tell me, how are the courts supposed to sift through those?
Well, the big thing on that is, and this is contrary to the state's argument about this being so simple, the witness has to actually have been in jail with the person they're saying recanted.
Yeah,
and that's very simple to prove, and you're going to have to find somebody. You know, in this case, 7 years later, finding somebody if they are not in fact telling the truth. 7 years later, finding somebody who was in jail in the same pod. It doesn't matter if you're in the same jail. You know, I've been in the Racine County Jail as a lawyer, not as a defendant. Thank goodness. But there are different pods. And they don't interact. And same thing at Waupun, same thing at Dodge. You know, they do not interact with other people. So first of all, you're going to have to track down somebody who was with this person at the right time. And if you can't do that, you're not going to be able to make a viable claim. So,
right. So
that gets back a lot of them.
Yeah, so, I mean, just to take a very cynical view of the whole thing, one could do one's research and find out who's in the pod with them and then approach them and see what you can get them to say.
And how are we going to do that when we're locked up in prison And we don't have access to either the records or, the jail records, let alone, the prison records, to find out who was there at the time. As a lawyer, it takes me a long time to find these things. And with the changes to the open records law, I don't think that that's something that that an inmate necessarily would be able to find that easily. It takes me months to track down that kind of stuff to confirm that when I have a case like this, and I have had several cases where people have been exonerated on less of an affidavit than this, where the trial witnesses for the state come back out and say, yes, of course I lied. I was, I wanted to get myself out of jail, and told that to the prosecutor who had trusted that person at the time of trial. But it took me, months to track down whether this person was actually in jail with the state's witness at the time. This isn't easy for somebody who's in prison to do. And I think that cuts back a lot of what the court's concerns are on that, because it really is not that simple to do. I've been doing this for 30 years, and I have brought a number of these kind of cases, but I had to do a heck of a lot of research that an inmate would not be able to do before I would be able to bring that type of a claim. In terms of Antonio Shannon's affidavit and, seeing this person run out, if you look at the affidavit itself says that Shannon was talking with this person. The person said he was involved in the robbery. And at that point said, oh, yeah, I saw you running out. So at the point that the identification was made, it was not back in 2006 or whatever. It was after Jefferson told him he was involved in the robbery and was running out. So there's nothing improbable or incredible about that at all. And I see my light is on. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you both for very interesting arguments on yet another newly discovered evidence wrinkle. You know them all, you find out you don't. So thank you very much. The court will meet in closed conference at 3:05. We are adjourned.